This week's episode is sponsored by RLJ Entertainment. Own season one of the chilling AMC series Nosferatu, starring Zachary Quinto and based on Joe Hill's best-selling novel, on Blu-ray and DVD today. Head to Amazon.com and order your copy today.
Tonight's episode of Shockwaves is also brought to you by Slasher Crasher, the debut horror comedy novel of David Nora. It was the night he tried to go home, but got caught in their drama. It's Halloween. Nick Roche, a towering figure of evil and stupidity, escapes from the upstate New York mental hospital he's been committed to for the last 5 years. Planning to return to his childhood home, where he brutally murdered his babysitter's boyfriend, his plans are halted when he crosses paths with an even more terrifying beast, two high school friends with some serious beef. Caught in the battle of loyalty that has been brewing for 10 years of their friendship, the two girls, Kayleen Strife and Betsy Coleman, force the feud into a savage showdown, pitting the escape monster against each other. Who will survive the epic death match? And it is totally wrong to fall in love with the murderous lunatic who just tried to kill your ex-best friend with a machete. It's available on Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com, and BlackRoseWriting.com. For more info, you can find David Nora on Twitter and Instagram at David Nora Jr. Again, the novel is Slasher Crasher.
The Sphere is back and scarier than ever. One of the world's most popular franchises, and one of my favorites, in the history of horror, the Phantasm film series has terrified fans for generations. Now get the exclusive Phantasm Sphere collection loaded with never-before-seen bonus features and an actual Phantasm Sphere replica. Look for it in December. It is the best gift ever, boy. And that is available from Wellgo USA.
Welcome to episode 165 of Shockwaves. I'm one of your hosts, Rob Galuzzo. I'm sitting here with one of your other hosts. The only non-slacker of the bunch that keeps showing up is Elric Kane.
I don't know how we're both standing.
I know. This is ridiculous.
I think I've been in three states in under 2 weeks. I was back for 1.5 days.
I was back for one. Yeah. No, we were both kind of in the same territory.
Madness.
It is madness. We did a lot of traveling. Rebecca's out. Unfortunately, she had an emergency come up at the last minute. She wanted to be here because we got basically the only reason we're doing this is because the guest later, we had like one shot to get this person on our show.
Yeah.
And we just had to take it, no matter how exhausted we are.
Yeah. And we will tell him as such.
We will
make sure he knows how special he was.
We will guilt him into how special he is.
And in case our brains don't function as well as a normal day. Because I got home about 1 a.m. last night after dropping you guys off
after
a flight.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Where we'd been in Knoxville for a few days. So we've hit a couple places. We obviously hit the Salem Horror Film Festival, which we'll talk about a little bit as well in an upcoming show. But that's a great town, great festival. We had some fun with that, as people probably heard, with the Crypt Keeper.
Oh my God.
John Cassier.
Yeah, that was last week's episode.
And that was really fun. It was a different episode for us. It was a new ground again, because it's one of the first I think we've ever had lots of clips part of. Obviously, for you at home, that's nowhere near as interesting or as exciting, that part of it, as it was in person.
Yeah,
it
was a lot of fun. And we had Jessica Locke, who was the festival manager for Salem Horror Fest, who's a big Tales from the Crypt fan. And we had Theo Burbank come on, who is one of the co-hosts with her sister of Freaky Franchise.
Yeah.
And she's a very young, loving horror fan. So we thought that was an interesting perspective, getting someone that's a generation behind us talking about Tales
from the
Crypt.
It was her mom who got her into horror, and her mom was there and talking about all the movies she watches with them. It was pretty cool. It was good. I love mixing up the live shows when we get a chance to go to a town and do something different like that.
Yeah.
And that was a lot of fun. And then we'll talk about
some of
that.
We can talk about it now, though, because we already aired the episode.
We did talk about that one, yeah.
The only downside for me, and this is just a scheduling thing, is you and I basically were like ships passing in the night.
That's right. We only hooked up about an hour and a half before the show or something.
Yeah.
And then the show.
Off
the next day,
New York.
I believe, yeah.
But you stayed. You were there a few days early to see Salem. I stayed a few days late and got to see Salem. I had a great time. I'd never been there. I didn't realize how insane it was in October in terms of how much of a tourist attraction it is and how Halloween-y it gets.
And all the stores have Halloween themes.
You everybody. Know? Everybody the gets whole town. Into it.
And, but also, like, you know, just some of the true stories behind it. You really do have to go there to bring it home.
Oh, yeah.
Like, to see a sign that says, you know, this man was pressed to death. That's the one that, like, got me. Like, all the hangings are one thing. But when somebody was pressed to death, you go, oh, yeah, that's not good.
That's not good.
Especially when you're trying to force that person to confess to something that's not true. You're like, oh, wow, that's... And it kind of is scary to think about how little distance it feels between now and then and how we haven't come that far, especially when you think of like that was something spread by a bunch of girls spreading a rumor, right? That spreads out of control. And you think about Twitter or something,
easy
it would be to demonize something on Twitter. So you're like, yeah, it's really not that different, except, you know, maybe the executions part. But it is a fascinating town. I would think everyone should just visit in general, but I do think seeing it in this season is obviously special. I'm sure if we got even closer to Halloween, it's probably even crazier.
Yeah, because we, on the weekend, so the festival was happening, and it's, you know, it was all in several spots kind of around town. One of which where we did the actual show, and there were some signings happening there and some vendors. And then, at the church, there was a theater and a church across the street from the theater, an old church that we watched Trick or Treat at Midnight.
Yeah.
And not Trick or Treat Michael Dougherty's. We're talking about Trick or Treat, the 1986 film, which, I guess we could talk a little bit. I know we're going to talk about it in our live episode, but,
we both thought it was a really good movie, like well made, fun, crazy. Like to me, this is like a great staple of Halloween movie. Like
oh,
I would
yeah.
add this
oh,
if I had a good version of it. That's the tricky part. That we were watching a German Blu-ray, so clearly you'd want to order that until there's, you know, I don't know, is it a music rights issue?
I'm not sure. Yeah. Maybe that's what it is. It's probably music, but it's got a great little cameo from Ozzy Osbourne. Gene Simmons plays the DJ Nuke, and it's the main kid is Mark Price. Who was Skippy on Family Ties.
Yeah.
And basically he's a big metal fan of Sammy Kerr.
Who's a real rock musician.
Sammy Kerr, I'm
Sammy
sorry.
Sammy Kerr, who's a real meddler.
Is he really or no?
No.
I didn't know either.
I truly believed. Something got in my head all these years where I heard about this film and Becky always talked about it, just that he was a real metal guy. Like I just had this. And so when I watched it, I believed he was a metal guy and it made everything better. Because I was like, oh, he's really good. But it turns out he's actually like a dancer or something because that's why his dance moves are so good.
Wow. You know, want to hear something wild? There's like six people credited for the screenplay of this and one story credit. But uncredited is Glenn Morgan and James Wong.
Whoa. Oh,
the guys
early.
That did like
X
Files,
yeah,
before X Files, before Final Destination,
crazy.
That's kind of cool, huh?
And before Black Xmas,
yeah. Oh, Christopher Young did the score,
yeah.
You know, who's another giant.
But yeah, it's a guy who's an outsider who basically worships Sammy Kerr, and one day he dies in a major fire. His idol dies in a major fire, and he kind of renounces metal briefly. He like rips everything out of rage off his wall, and Gene Simmons hands him this album that they're going to play, the last recording by that artist that they're going to play on Halloween at midnight. So when he plays, it got a bit of a Lords of Salem time.
Yeah.
So when he plays the record in advance of that, he basically unleashes the Sammy Kerr spirit, who's a dark entity trying to get even with the town that didn't want him, let him play at his original high school dance or whatever. So it's all time. But it's got some cool gory deaths. And it's like, I think this eternal hunt for more great 80s horror is always out there for like the Scream Factories and that. And this is obviously one of them. Like, I mean, using the word great might be too grandiose, right? But super fun. And it fits into
super
those
fun
kind of
and
movies.
Just, again, very, very well made.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we were just like, wow, this is kind of, you know, I can't remember. Was it Dino? One of those big companies was the credit at the beginning. And yeah, it had a very Nightmare on Elm Street 3 vibe.
Yeah, like, definitely felt like an Elm Street sequel.
Yeah.
For sure. But everything about it's fun. Definitely a good party film, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So setting the tone for Halloween nicely with that one.
Yeah, and I would hunt around, but because there is a German Blu-ray of this floating around. And, you know, again, kudos to Kevin Lynch, who runs the Salem Horror Fest and invite us out. And because this played, I think, at the same time that you and I were doing Shockwaves.
Yeah, and that was actually the thing I was most bummed, because that's just a movie I was very curious to see. I'd never seen it. And when he was willing to do it after ours, I was like, all right.
Yeah, that's pretty rad.
That's a shocker after our own heart.
Yeah.
And before you got there, the reason I went a couple of days early was I got to see a live performance by John Waters.
Oh, wow.
And he did a 90-minute set, basically stand-up routine, no notes, no missed beat. Like, it's all in his head, and it's hilarious and totally politically incorrect. Probably further isolated the town away from the festival, because he's like, he was already having some issues with the visitor center and some Trump supporter that sounded interesting, that was like creating some conflict with the festival.
Yeah.
But you know, you have to, if you run a festival or if you run anything, you have to be completely true to your principles. You can't just try to, you know, go to the middle. You have to be true to what you represent. And yeah. So I think that's pretty cool. But John Waters, it was in the really high-end art gallery. Mm-hmm. And apparently afterwards, what I heard from some people there was just like, some of the people in the art gallery didn't realize what they're getting. And some people who came in the audience who didn't know John Waters was.
Oh.
We're not sure what they're getting in for.
Surprise.
You know, self-proclaimed most vile man alive. He is very funny. And yeah. It was so cool. Of all the auteurs I can think of, he's probably remained most, I mean, Lynch as well, most him, and doesn't look different, doesn't
consistent,
feel different,
yeah.
Still dresses the same, still has tons of energy.
Yeah.
Doesn't seem to be upset that he doesn't get to make movies anymore. He's just more like, he's accepted now. He just like changed what he does now. And now it's about writing books and traveling and talking about the movies he got to make, you know? So it was really cool. So kudos, good festival if you get a chance to go.
Yeah. You know what? If you're in Salem, it's kind of still happening. Like, right, this upcoming weekend is Stephen King weekend. They're showing a bunch of Stephen King movies, everything from the original 1990 It to Cujo to Carrie to Christine to Misery, Dead Zone, Pet Cemetery. And nice. then in late November, they're doing an Addams Family Thanksgiving, which is going to be cool. All-day marathon of Addams Family. I think it's Addams Family episodes and the two Barry Sonnenfeld movies, which are great. Yeah, they're special. It's for Black Friday. they're doing
a bunch
of the episodes.
It goes on a long time. This is a festival that's spread out over a long period, so they have obviously different kind of parts of it. You know, some are more interactive, some are more film festival-y.
Yeah. But we had a great time, and I enjoyed the city very much, and I'm definitely going to go back at some point and just continue to explore. And then we went to Knoxville Horror Film Festival.
Well, before we leave Salem, I will say it might be a slight hint towards our guest later. I'm sure there's a tie in.
Well, because his movie premiered at the where'd we go? We went to the because there's all this sort of Salem witch stuff there. We went, you and I both separately went to the Satanic Temple.
Oh yeah, Baphomet. I sat on Baphomet's lap.
As did I. That was kind of fun.
I said to him, "You get wood, Padre."
Yeah.
But it was actually really cool. It was like an art gallery, like with some amazing art pieces. If you haven't been and are scared of the devil, I wouldn't be scared of this. This is a very, and there's a documentary out there right now, Hail Satan, which is all about the Church of Satan. And it seemed like a really cool place.
Yeah. But it was the Salem Witch Museum.
Mm-hmm. Where it tells you the story.
They did the premiere of The Witch there, the press event there. So maybe we'll ask our guest about how that worked out.
Actually, that's cool. Yeah, I like
cool
that.
Cool tie-in.
That's fascinating.
And yeah, and then we went to Knoxville, which you went last year, and we've been friends with William Mahaffey, who runs it and now owns the Central Cinema, which definitely felt like a spiritual sister to the Jump Cut Cafe.
I really did, yeah. If I'd had the space and could have done that.
Dude. Oh my God, it would have been incredible.
I know.
And then we could have room for my video store in the back too.
Exactly. You could have done it all, man. But I love those guys. I love how community vibe it is. And this was a little different from my trip last time. Last time was like way more social in a sense, because it was just me and hanging out with everyone. And this time was like us as a three rolling into town. We had a rent car. We're like getting around. We did we did our live show. We did trivia. I was judging the features, so I had to watch a lot. We had to cram in a bit there. But we got a lot in a few days. And, we kicked off with Girdlerthon.
Oh, my God,
a
yes.
A three-film tribute to William Girdler, whose career was very close, you know, is in Louisville, which is nearby. And we got to – so we watched them in – we saw Manitou, Grizzly, and – Abby.
Yes.
And on film. That was the cool part about the Abby. And it was increasingly bonkers day. I don't know how you increase your bonkers from Manitou, but somehow we did.
Yeah. No, it's wild because, again, it's one of those filmmakers that, like, again, like, I laugh when – I love that you champion, like, these oddball filmmakers. Like, no one in the world, I think, was proposing Girdlerthon.
I definitely
I think you're the only one. And to William's credit, he made it happen.
Yeah, no, I mean, he was really into it because I guess it's, you know, regional to him. And I think that must be a really appealing thing to know that this can happen. Because that is the weird thing. Some of his films obviously feel big, happen in San Francisco, Manitou. But the ones like even when you're watching Abby and you're like, oh yeah, this is set in Louisville. Like, it's a weird thing to do in a sense. It's like really cool. I mean, regional filmmaking is the best. But yeah, we've been traveling. So if we sound like we're dying, it's just
we are just dying
slowly. This is our slow. And people who don't think we do enough in October, trust me, we're doing more than enough in October.
More than enough. Yes.
But those three films played really well because they're also so different. Seeing Grizzly on a big screen was really great because I'd never done that and I didn't really remember it that well. And just realizing, it's just a slasher movie that happens to have a bear.
It used to be Grizzly to me was always a very okay movie, a movie that's maybe about 10 minutes longer than it should be. But seeing it with an audience responding to the attack sequences and just the whole setup, and you can't beat like the finale of that movie, which is very much like Jaws.
Well, there's when you watch it next time, there's just this one dude who's so excited to sleep with his girlfriend that night.
Oh yeah,
and his girlfriend goes to get ready, and the look on his face is my favorite thing in any movie. And it just, let's just say he doesn't get to in the end.
Yeah,
it's very sad.
And that's one of those moments that maybe at home you wouldn't find as funny, but you're in an audience and you see this guy's expression on his face, and everybody laughs out loud.
That's great.
And yeah, it's just, that's what I love about the theatrical experience, is those moments stand out.
And older movies have that. That's one thing that is missing when you watch even Abby, right? If you're just watching at home, you might laugh at some parts or go, what? Or holy shit. But watching it with a crowd, you really start to see other things in it.
Yeah.
And this time I started to respect the movie a lot more than I had. I always thought it was wildly entertaining, but this time I was like, oh no, that's actually
these
characters are really like good characters, and I like them more than the Exorcist characters. It's not a better film than Exorcist, but I liked the characters more. Like, I'm more invested in, oh, I want it to work out for them, you know?
Yeah. And it's not similar to The Exorcist. I want to investigate what the rights issue is with that.
I mean, it just, to me, it has to have been, I don't know, the current rights issues, I'm sure, is something probably somewhat different than what it would have been back then. But back then, it was probably just the timing. You jump on the heels of something that just made all this money. You basically are just doing it, but with a black demographic. And, you know, yes, it's not the exact story, but it's got a guy coming in to perform an exorcism.
Yeah.
It's not a little girl in this case. It's like a wife. It gets to be, you know, a lot more sexual. There's some pretty amazing lines in there.
Yeah.
She's not a good sex, a couple's therapist. But it is super fun. And that was just a great, great night. It seemed to be a perfect way to launch into things.
Yeah. And then, you know, some of the movies we saw, we could delve into some of them.
Yeah. This is probably the only time we're going to mention some of them. I remember one of the ones we kicked off, one you had already seen, Fingers.
Oh yeah. I love
probably
Fingers.
My favorite viewing of the festival. It doesn't mean, it's not my favorite horror film. I wouldn't even put it on a horror film list.
Yeah. It's not a horror film really.
No, it's more like a cult movie. You know, like I said to you afterwards, Todd Solondz does Cheap Thrills, but
amazing, which is the perfect description. So this is directed by Juan Ortiz. It's his first feature. And it was shot by Christian Stella, who does all the Jeremy Gardner movies. And it stars Jeremy Gardner from The Battery and After Midnight, as well as what's his name? Michael St. Michael?
Yeah, Michael St. Michael.
AKA the Greasy Strangler.
Who has a couple of the best lines of the year in this movie. And his deliveries are just so good.
It's one of the darkest comedies I've ever seen, because the first 30 minutes, you're kind of following this character who's just awful.
Yeah, she's a terrible. That's why it feels like a Todd Solondz character. It feels like someone from Happiness, one of the women in Happiness who's just miserable, and she's paranoid. She's scared of anything. She's a total racist. Everything about her is unappealing, but it's all kind of a phobia and feels very much about the current climate we're in. And then it starts opening up to even weirder things. Like, there's just the one guy who comes to her office and he's missing a finger, and with no explanation of why he's missing a finger, and it's freaking her out. So she's trying to get somebody to fire him, just get him out of here.
Yeah.
I don't even want to see him. Just get him out of here. And of course, the next day comes to work, and he has another finger gone.
Yeah,
and that's where so you don't really, and a lot of the threads don't fully come together until very late. And by the time it all does, it's just so wacky, and you've changed perspective of who you follow a lot in the film.
Yeah,
that's why it also feels like a Solondz thing, because he does that in all those movies. There isn't really a central character. It felt like it was going to be at the start, and then it took a different direction. I don't know. I just had so much fun watching it.
Well, and then the second Jeremy Gardner comes in, which is that 30-minute mark, it's one of his best performances.
I think it's one of his best roles. Like, I mean, it was definitely, if it wasn't for Stephen Lang and VFW, Jeremy was going to get my actor of the fest thing. So he was like the very club, but Stephen Lang, you know, we'll get to that in a sec, is just a beast, and we gotta celebrate when a guy comes like. But yeah, this is a super fun film. I hope it finds a home. And we will just have to keep telling people about it. It's one of those fun calls. It also reminded me, remember last year I saw that film, we started at Chattanooga. It was kind of like a Pulp Fiction-y indie that had the guy with the Mexican wrestling mask on. The name is totally Low Life.
I love Low Life.
The other film it really reminds me. It's not polished in the way Low Life's a very polished indie. It looks like it's expensive, even though it's not. Whereas this one, you know it's low budget, and it's not about the film. I'm not saying it's not about the filmmaking. It's less about the perfection of the craft as it is about like the storytelling.
Yeah.
But yeah, this one to keep an eye out for sure if you have a dark sense of humor.
Fingers.
And then that went right into After Midnight, which in retrospect, it's hard to think if they're totally different tonally, but it's also weird to see Jeremy in two totally back-to-back in such different roles. Yeah. But this is a great movie, and this is one I'm sure we'll both be championing and talking about for a long time.
It was my favorite of the festival, and you know, obviously people have been following it under the title Something Else, and this is the follow-up. I consider this the official follow-up to The Battery, which was a film that we very championed very much in our Killer POV days. So it's basically the same core team doing, for lack of a better term, the way The Battery was this really great drama with a touch of zombie. This is the Battery-esque version of a creature feature. Mm-hmm. It's a small element of it, but really it's a beautifully crafted, romantic drama, that's disguised as a creature feature movie.
Yeah, and it has some, you know, a couple of moments of real payoff. Has one of the best jumps you'll ever get. But it's also got a lot of heart. It's definitely a motion movie. I mean, yeah, we were talking about some similarities with, not similarities in storytelling, but in feel to Spring.
Oh, yeah.
Which obviously Rustic are the company who made it. So
helped make it, and Justin Benson, who wrote it, stars in this one.
He's got a role as a cop.
I think that'd be a great, After Midnight and Spring would be a perfect double bill. I think those two would play really well together.
Because they're different enough, for sure.
And I said it, but she won Best Actress. Knoxville is Brie Grant is just terrific in this movie.
That's why I wish the movie was called Abby. That's why I said
because her character's name is Abby. Yeah. And we were like, they should call this Abby.
Because it is all about her. It's all about his feelings for her. That's what's so. But it is a very sweet natured film, and Jeremy Gardner walking around with a gun is great. It's a great drinking movie. It's definitely about characters living the life, and it has a great guest performance, not guest, but the kind of other lead actor, his friend character, he's a bit of a deadbeat, is an actor who I didn't recognize when I first saw the name. You'll find it before me, but it turns out he's one of the podcasters of Last Podcast on the Left.
Oh, yeah. It's, why am I not finding it?
Yeah, well, either way, you'll come across it. He basically got all the great lines, and kind of gives you a different side to the Gardner character, who's like very authentically wounded.
Henry Zebrowski. Sorry about that. He's terrific. He steals the movie. There's a really – it inspired our trivia game. Basically, there's a bar term / moment I didn't know about it, and it's disgusting, called gorilla farts. If you're aware of what that is at a bar, one of our Dead Right Hard trivia people picked that as their team name, which I thought was a great little tribute. But he's really great. He steals the show, and it's just a great movie. I think it's going to come out early next year. So definitely keep an eye out for After Midnight. For me, let's see. We saw Kindred Spirits, which is a new Lucky McKee movie.
Yep.
And it's so bizarre because it is absolutely the blueprint for like what a Lifetime movie, but done through Lucky's kind of awkward, weird lens. Mm-hmm. he's got these, basically it's kind of a thriller about a very, very young mom played by Thora Birch. I turned to you and I was like, holy shit, Thora Birch's mom age now, which makes us feel kind of old.
And then I said to you, she's now the age Steve Buscemi is in Ghost World, which is really weird.
Yeah. So it's her and her young daughter, and basically her little, Thora Birch's little sister comes home after being kind of mysteriously away for a year. And immediately kind of reconnects with the daughter, and they become almost inseparable and start to look like each other. And,
single white femaling.
It becomes that. Yeah, very much so. And it's an interesting manipulative kind of drama in that way. But really, I mean, the superstar is Macon Blair.
Macon Blair plays the dad of the girl's friend, who's also having an affair with the mom. Or not an affair, because they're both single, but they're having a secret relationship.
Yes.
He's really great. But I think the main girl who's also she's the cheerleader, main cheerleader in All Cheerleaders Must Die, by the same team, basically. She's really good. Caitlin Stacey, you're saying? She's particularly strong in the first half of this movie. She just has a lot to work with and you don't really know her intentions. I think it's one of those stories that because at some point it plays its cards, it takes some of the where you can go with the performance out, you know, that you kind of get, it's kind of like in Stepfather, once you know he's the stepfather and everything's out on the table where he's going, it's harder to maintain that. Yeah. So for me, but I definitely, went to Becca halfway through. I was like, this is Psycho Granny. And she's like, this is the Lifetime model. And it is produced by the Mar Vista company. So, and that's the company who did a lot of Lifetime movies. So it could have, for all we know, we might find out that this is a film that gets a festival run and then gets recut with less gore. Cause there's a couple of really gory scenes in it that wouldn't appear on TV. Maybe it gets recut and is in that model, and that's how they got it made. And if so, cool. You know, it still has Lucky's spin on it.
Yeah, no, it's a really good one. So that's Kindred Spirits. Let's see what else is worth talking about.
Evil Dead, the Redux.
4K, yeah, with the new score.
That was pretty cool. We had some, like, I mean, seeing Evil Dead on big screen is all good anyway. So we're already winning. I definitely felt like at the start, and Becca said a couple times, she was like, oh, this is like kind of taking me out of it.
Yeah. It's a little alarming when you know a movie so well.
And it's quiet. It's a movie that has lots of great use of quiet.
Yeah.
And I think that can be unnerving when you're making something indie. But yeah, there was just some parts at the start where I'm like, well, I don't need much score at the start because they're just driving to a freaking cabin, right? And there's quite a lot of score during that. But you know, it's fun to see it in a different way. I'd say if this was going to be your first time watching this movie, I'd probably wouldn't recommend with the score.
Yeah.
But as a long time, you know, there's part that I kind of used as the example, which is where the wood seat outside is thumping
yeah.
when they first get there, and then it abruptly stops. And I always remember the quiet of that moment being alarming. And instead, there's a little bit of score that just kind of keeps going. And I was like, I kind of want that moment. But once it hits its stride, it had some pretty amazing sequences, especially with the carnage sequences.
Yeah.
I definitely thought the tree rape scene, which is always disturbing, was even more disturbing this time. Maybe it's a little more horror-ish, you know?
It almost felt like there's a little too much score, new score in the first 20 minutes, and then it evens out.
Yeah.
And then whatever new stuff is in there is like really impressive mm-hmm. and really added to the experience. But yeah, I mean, this is just a cool new way to see a movie that we've loved for whatever, 30 some odd years now. So almost 40.
Yeah, yeah.
New Evil Dead, if it comes near you, definitely check it out.
I had seen Bliss already, and our flight left before Bliss, so you couldn't get to see it yet. But it played with VFW.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm excited for you to get to see it with the score, because the Steve Moore score on this is really good and really makes this like so feel like Assault on Precinct 13.
Yeah.
And I got to say, like, I'm just sitting there going, I don't know what to expect. You know, I like the cast that I had read about, you know, and then once, you know, it kind of opens with the mutant kind of punk characters. I'm like, okay, yeah, I've seen these kind of characters before. But once you get into the bar and you get Stephen Lang and George Wendt and Marty Cove and Fred Williamson and William Sadler and the guy from Twin Peaks and the Warriors.
Oh, yeah.
Whose name just escapes me. Once they're all in there, I completely fell in love with them. I like completely just loved these guys and want to root for them to hang out and defend their little piece of land. And so basically somebody rips off this, you know, punk drug kingpin in a world where these drugs are obviously hyper going to mess you up, hides in a VFW bar where Stephen Lang is the owner. And because she's hiding out in there, these mutant punks literally who all want their drug score are all basically descending to fuck them up and take the drugs back. And these old guys make a stand, you know, and just all these people that you've always loved. And Stephen Lang especially is good. The reason I think he's such a good performance, he's also playing about 20 years older than he is.
Yeah.
So he's like, he's playing a 75-year-old and this dude's probably 60, you know, if that. And everyone else, Fred Williamson is definitely, I would bet, almost 20 years older than Lang. And yet you'd completely buy it. You know, like their relationships and kind of the ranges between, so I think Sadler's really good in this too, playing not the normally tough guy. Like he's the demon knight guy. You think he's going to be that guy, but no, in this, he's kind of the like almost comic relief, but also the guy you want to see come back. And I just love seeing them band together. And this is way more my kind of bag than Expendables in terms of those kind of characters.
Oh, yeah.
And so, but the thing, I didn't see this without the Steve Moore score, right? Like seeing this with that, you see how it pulls elements like a movie like this has held together sometimes. Not because it needs to be held together, but some movies, a score can do that.
Oh, yeah.
And this score just like has that, it just totally carries a lot of this movie. I thought it was really well done and well pulled off. And kudos to Joe, because that can't be easy seeing all these guys. And Marty Cove's really good.
Marty Cove. And what's funny is Marty Cove, it's funny because he did a movie called Steel Justice like in the late 80s, early 90s, whatever, where he's like the hero. I just can never see him as a hero because he's the bad guy. But this is the one where I actually bought him as like Marty. Oh, okay. Marty Cove is probably really
like. He said sweep the leg. I can't believe, they can never forgive him for that.
Yeah.
But I thought this was really good. And the two punch, I'm not sure which one I like better. I think Bliss, I'm still most impressed by just like the art that kind of Joe found from his, compared to the films leading up to it, where I feel like it leads to a really interesting place, the end of Bliss. People haven't checked out, but VFW is a step in another direction. He's directing somebody else's thing. He's, going all out. And I think it's going to be I think it'll be a real audience pleaser for the right audience for Fango. I think this is a good title for a company like that to put out, in my opinion, because of all the elements, the stars, the gore, the music. It's like, no, if you can get it to the right people.
Yeah.
The festival circuit's an easy win, right? It's like, what do you do with these kind of movies after that? I don't know. But I think this one will play great. And I had a lot of fun with that one.
Cool. Tammy and the T-Rex, I finally saw it.
Oh, yeah.
Man.
I kind of wish I'd gotten to see it again on this one. I can't remember what I had to do, but I had to
I don't know, man. I get the appeal. This is a long-lost movie from the 90s. Yeah, it was from 1994, and it stars a very, very, very young Denise Richards, Paul Walker, who looks like a baby in it, pretty much. And they are a couple. Her boyfriend really wants to kill him. It's that, it's kind of that holdover from the late 80s where there's always like the jerk boyfriend that's about to kill you. He succeeds sort of in a very interesting way. And then Terry Kaiser shows up, Bernie from Weekend of Bernie's himself, because he's a mad scientist that has built an electronic T-Rex. The only way he wants it to work is by putting a brain into it. So he puts Paul Walker's brain in a T-Rex. And then what happens, apparently this movie got released in a very limited way, and the T-Rex kills the bullies in very hyper gory ways.
Yeah, it's a revenge film, basically.
Basically, well, just for that portion, and then, but apparently all that got cut out, so now it's back in, and it is a bizarre. This is exactly what I think of when I think of a cult movie.
Oh yeah.
A very bizarre cult movie,
and even more so when when there's a story like this where it's like, oh, they cut out the gore and tried to give it to a teen market, and you're a teen market, because it's all about it's all sex. I mean, it's the ending's bonkers.
The whole thing is so bonkers. Vinegar Syndrome is going to put this out soon, I think in November. But right now it's kind of touring the festival circuit. And, whatever. I like it. It's a fun experience. It's a fun experience in the theaters. Audiences are different. The thing, not to knock the Knoxville audience because I love them and all, but this was definitely a movie that everybody went in to laugh at.
Yeah.
And so I get it. It was funny. It's goofy. It's supposed to be. But I was a little annoyed because the people behind me were laughing at literally every single line,
right,
as if it was the funniest thing ever. And even I was kind of like, calm down. It's not, not every single thing in this movie is a complete funny
but
disaster.
They're holding each other's nuts for a very long time.
That was funny. That was an
that
awkward
was one of the strangest
awkward maneuver in the
choices.
Middle of a fight is to grab your opponent's junk and
just
then they grab
go.
Yours
and you just keep holding on.
You just keep holding on for dear life
while you're surrounded by a group of people cheering. It's very odd. It's a fun. This is definitely a party movie. Like, this is one watching it alone would be interesting and holy fucking shit, but watching it in a group is a different experience.
Yeah, for sure. Tammy and the T-Rex, check that one out.
Yeah.
Any other festival ones, because I want to delve outside of festivals and go back to
I mean, I think that's most of the things we saw. Yeah.
Well, I wanted to give a little love to Eat Brains Love, which is the new movie from Rodman Flender, and it opened up Screamfest, which was a couple weeks ago here in Los Angeles, and it's based on a novel or a series of books, actually. I think it's a couple of young adult novels. Let me see if I can get the writing credits handy. It doesn't say. But anyways, so this is kind of – it's pretty fascinating because it's so – it seems like now, 20 years later, Idle Hands is finding its audience. Because I didn't know – I forgot this. Rodman had told us about it. But Idle Hands came out 10 days after Columbine. Oh, yeah, that's right. And so people were very sensitive about violence in movies, kids, you know, teenage kids doing violence, even though Idle Hands is a very goofy stoner comedy.
Yeah.
Right. But it's great. It's a lot of fun, a lot of fun actors. And he had just been part of a reunion screening with everybody there here in Los Angeles. And now this kind of comes along and it's that same guy. Like you see Eat Brains Alive and it's got, it is 100% the guy that made Idle Hands, like that type of humor and tone, and kind of like off kilter. It's quirky. It's got that very quirky, fun tone. And it's basically, they treat zombieism, you know, and that's the other thing. I'm usually sick of zombies, but it's a very romantic zombie road movie where basically the high school stoner who has no ambition and the hot girl that he's in love with both contract this zombie disease. And it's almost like a werewolf thing where they both freak out in the middle of the lunchroom and then just like start eating and tearing people apart in the lunchroom. And then and then it goes away after you're done eating and you kind of turn back to normal. It's just after a while, like you get the hunger again and you start to like zombie out.
It's like those Snickers ads.
Pretty much. And so they pretty much go on the road because first of all, they're on the run for murder, of their entire like high school class. And then they kind of run into, two girls that are also kind of the same zombie, culted. It's basically becomes a cult. There's people out there that are zombies. There's rumors in Ohio. There's a cure. Maybe we'll go there and just get a cure, etc. And he just wants to kind of like hook up with the hot girl. And on their tail is an organization that kind of hunts these zombies down and kills them. And it's run by one of the guys. Let me look up his name. He's
James Woodson, the Catholic Church.
close enough. No, it's the guy. He's in Better Called Saul. And why are we so terrible with names?
It's because we've just been traveling
and we're just kind of out of it right now. But, he's being trapped by them and another young girl who's got a whole like Sigourney Weaver Ripley thing going on. And they actually comment saying, yeah, Ripley, like they make jokes about it. Who's clairvoyant. She's got some psychic abilities. And so she touches things. She could kind of see what happened in that environment and track the zombies. But what happens is by touching the stoner zombies, like, possessions and seeing him, she almost falls in love with him. It's like love at first sight. And so it's a love triangle between a stoner, the hot girl from school and the psychic girl who's tailing them, basically with the intent to capture and kill them. It's a lot of fun. A lot of fun. And, it kicked off Screamfest. I thought everyone had a great time with it. And again, it just makes me sad that, you know, Rodman has done a lot of films, a lot of documentaries, in between, but it makes me sad that we don't have five other horror comedies from Rodman in between these two movies. And so I hope this one does well. I think, Alter, Gunpowder and Skies Company is going to be putting this out soon.
Oh, cool.
And so hopefully, it'll get out there and people that love Idle Hands will check it out and we can get more movies like this from Rodman because it's just a blast.
Similar tone to that. I was watching the first half of, Dead Alive / Brain Dead, Becca's class today.
Oh, yeah.
And I just kind of walked in because I hadn't seen it in a while, but this is a movie I know like the back of my hand because I grew up on it and it's all the locations that, you know, it's like talking in the back door. Oh, I used to walk through there, but man, talk about an energy you miss from a director.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
like that energy that it's so similar to Raimi. You realize like he is just packing every moment with energy and like zeal and fun performance and interesting camera angle and movement. Like I could only say for the first half, so I'm going to, but it left me going, oh, I got to watch the rest later tonight.
Oh, yeah.
Because
yeah,
it's just so fun and it's so exciting to see a director like that. And I'm glad he's going to go back and like, you know, remaster those. My hope is that maybe we'll get a Sam Raimi situation like Drag Me to Hell at some point where he returns to the fold.
Yeah, for sure. You know, it's funny you mentioned that. It's semi-related, but the last time I watched Pee-wee's Big Adventure, again, same thing with Tim Burton. You go back to those first few movies and there's so much enthusiasm and joy and just everything packed in every frame. Even Danny Elfman, his score. Is it Deja Vu again?
Yeah, I'm getting Deja Vu again. Sometimes
I'm sure
inside joke. I want us to get our first one-star review going, I don't know what they were talking about all of a sudden. It got very Deja Vu-y.
Yeah. Oh, you know what? Here's two quick things I want to talk about new to streaming services. So on Netflix, In the Tall Grass, which is the new this was based on a story by both Stephen King and Joe Hill, and it was adapted for Netflix by Vincenzo Natali, the guy who did Cube.
Splice, yeah.
And Splice. And I thought this was pretty excellent. Patrick Wilson is one of the actors in it. And it's just – it's one of those fun – it totally makes sense. It's almost like the guy that did Cube playing on a much bigger field with a lot more toys, because basically it's this brother and sister driving along the road. They pull over because she's pregnant and, you know, kind of feels sick, and they hear a little boy screaming from this giant field with tall grass, just like, hey, help me. I'm lost. I can't get out, blah, 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 blah. And they both go in separately to try to find him. And the second they're in there, now they're just completely lost. Mm. Like, they can't find each other. They can't find the road. There's other people lurking in there too that are also kind of like, you're not 100% sure what's going on.
That sounds like Cube.
Yeah. And I found it very unsettling. There's this great moment. It's like right at the beginning where, the brother and sister are close enough that they hear each other's voices. They're like, oh, okay, all right, I hear you. You sound like you're right over there. Just jump up so I could see you. And so they both jump up, and you see them, I don't know, maybe 20 feet apart. Hmm. And they're like, okay, jump up again. And the next time they do it, they're like 50 feet apart. Hmm. And you're like, whoa.
Cool. Yeah.
That was super spooky.
Is it science fiction?
I don't know. It's definitely, it's definitely in that Children of the Corn vibe, where there's some element, basically there's a, I mean, there's no real explanation, but there is a rock that's at the center of, this grass field, that may be controlling or manipulating what's happening there. Hmm. And then they run into a family, which is Patrick Wilson and his wife, and the little boy is his son. And there's a dog in there, and it gave, even though it's in this environment that is wide open, it just gave me such claustrophobic anxiety because you're stuck in a situation you just can't get out of. And there's a couple of twists and turns. I really liked the film. I thought it was really cool. And I also love the way that Vincenzo directed it, because again, you could just do something in a field and whatever, but he really hones in on the space and how isolated and yet confined it feels. Some people have liked it, some people haven't. They said it's a little different from the source material, which I think is originally a novella. So then, of course, he has had to expand on this to make it a feature. But you know what? Again, it's like Netflix, I think, does really good King adaptations, you know, between this and Gerald's Game. Love the one with Thomas Jane.
Yeah.
Was it 1932? I don't know if I'm getting the date right. There's some really cool direct, adaptations they're doing there. So I had a blast at this one. And then the other one, hold on a second. I want to make sure I get that. Yeah, it's 1922.
Becca was championing, what was it? She was championing Marianne?
Yes, which I haven't had a chance to check out yet, but I know that's, is it a foreign series?
Yeah, I think it's German.
Okay. So that's also on Netflix now. It's a French series. I haven't had a chance to dive into it, but I did go and watch The Furies, which is a new Shudder original.
Oh, I saw The Furies.
Oh, you did? Where did you see it? At a festival?
Wait, is that the Australian one?
I think so, yeah.
With the Beauty and the Beast?
Yes.
Okay, so I must have seen it on Shudder too. I couldn't remember if I talked about it here. It's on my list, but I was like, I had this like weird moment. I was like, did I talk about this a couple weeks ago or not? Maybe not.
Because I watched it. I watched it almost as soon as it got added to Shudder, and I haven't had a chance to talk about it on the show yet. But I saw a lot of people in the Shockwaves group mentioning it, and I was like, oh, let me check this out. And basically, it's a woman that's kidnapped and wakes up kind of in a deadly game scenario where there's a slasher coming after her. And then, you know, eventually she crosses paths with another woman. And your whole Beauty and the Beast analogy is pretty fun. There's kind of a more intricate game at play here. Mm-hmm. And each of these girls has kind of a signified, their own slasher that is tied to them.
Right.
Or assigned to
them. Their life depends on each other. So they're entwined, but they don't necessarily know who that is straight away. and they're playing the game blind. It has some really good moments and some good gore and some good like intrigue in that kind of game-like way. It has good energy. It's made like everyone looks like a Texas Chainsaw Massacre Leatherface type villain, and these girls have no idea why they're there, and there's very little explanation about anything, which I always think is probably the better way to go than trying to explain what this is all about. I think if they'd given us too much explanation, we'd probably, you know, you'd probably roll your eyes. It's not always fulfilling to get so little, but in the same token. But yeah, no, this one, I think maybe Patrick Bromley had reviewed it on F This Movie and had liked it a lot, so it made me watch it. And I was like, no, I was glad I did. I was like, no, this is a good movie. This is a good, solid, you know.
It's a cool new surprise for the Halloween season. It's not like exactly a slasher film that I would be like, oh, this is amazing. But it was really interesting and different enough. Mm-hmm. And again, it had kind of that that Cube, you know, Dangerous Game sort of vibe to it. And yet the gore was great. Like, there's one sequence basically where the slasher's got an axe and the girl is against a tree fighting against him. And he's just slowly moving the axe into her face and basically
chops
it off. Yeah. You're like, just the front part of the face. And it's like, wow, that was a really good gore gag. So if you're looking for something a little on the nastier side that kind of homages and goes back to the 80s, like gore stuff, this is kind of really cool.
Yeah.
And again, it's like, it's always a fun surprise to find.
But they come out of
Shutter.
Nowhere. It's like, you've never heard of the production. You didn't know what's happening. It's frontish being shot in Australia. And then it looks kind of big.
Yeah.
In that way where it doesn't look like a tiny little indie thing. No, it's – yeah, I thought it was actually a lot of fun.
Yeah, so that one's on Shudder. It's called The Furies. And let's see. Anything else you wanted to bring up?
No, I mean, I've just been like literally in these two festivals. like I said before, I wasn't just saying it to promote that episode. I watched a lot of Tales from the Crypt.
Yeah.
I watched all of my episode picks that you hear on that one. I watched all of your picks. I watched all of John's picks. And I watched most of Jessica's, I think all but one, and I didn't get to many of Theo's because we got those lists late. But like, so that means I watched, you know, 21 episodes leading up to that show, and I loved every second of it. Like, and it was such an easy lift. And I didn't mind watching on my computer either, like on Amazon. It just totally is the season for me. So this Halloween, I'm going to remember probably my feeling of having watched rewatched a lot of Tales from Crypt and just how different they all are, and really enjoyed that.
Yeah, and you know, you could get there's a DVD set on Amazon for like, I think it's just a little under $70, and it's all seven seasons. So that's like, that is a lot of all-star horror, both all-stars directing and starring. Because, again, it's like I'm looking forward to showing you know, Alyssa will be in town in a few days. I'm going to show – I don't think she's seen any of these. Mm-hmm. So I think it'll be fun. I'm going to go through our favorite picks.
Oh, cool.
And, you know, by the time you listen to this, hopefully – I think we'll list our episodes from the episode – and get other people's choices, because that's the fun of this, is everyone remembers a different one, or I love the one with this star or that person. So,
do we think there might be a video version of the show at some point? Of the episode we did.
Oh, the Salem one. Yeah, apparently somebody, you know, we'll have to look into that and report back, but apparently somebody had recorded it for a TV local access show or something like that. So if it pops up online, we'll definitely share it. So,
but yeah, definitely helped having the clips. It really kind of got you excited. But what's that episode, that Death of Some Salesman? In terms of performance, if there's an MVP, Tim Curry under that much makeup, he is next level. If you're looking to laugh right now, if you're sad sitting at home, I would say buy that episode. Sit back and enjoy yourself.
Yeah. All right, let's get our guest on here.
Yeah, no, this is out. we're gonna be diving into some really major, well, one of the biggest horror movies of the last decade, and one of the most fascinating new movies of this year that doesn't fit easily into any genre, I'd say.
Yeah.
With a director we've wanted to talk about since very beginning.
All right. We'll be back after another word from our sponsors.
This week's episode is sponsored by RLJ Entertainment. Own season one of the chilling AMC series Nosferatu, starring Zachary Quinto and based on Joe Hill's best-selling novel, on Blu-ray and DVD today. Head to Amazon.com and order your copy today.
Tonight's episode of Shockwaves is also brought to you by Slasher Crasher, the debut horror comedy novel of David Nora. It was the night he tried to go home, but got caught in their drama. It's Halloween. Nick Roche, a towering figure of evil and stupidity, escapes from the upstate New York mental hospital he's been committed to for the last 5 years. Planning to return to his childhood home, where he brutally murdered his babysitter's boyfriend, his plans are halted when he crosses paths with an even more terrifying beast, two high school friends with some serious beef. Caught in the battle of loyalty that has been brewing for for 10 years of their friendship, the two girls, Kayleen Strife and Betsy Coleman, force the feud into a savage showdown, pitting the escape monster against each other. Who will survive the epic death match? And it is totally wrong to fall in love with the murderous lunatic who just tried to kill your ex-best friend with a machete. It's available on Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com, and BlackRoseWriting.com. For more info, you can find David Nora on Twitter and Instagram at David Nora Jr. Again, the novel is Slasher Crasher.
The Sphere is back and scarier than ever. One of the world's most popular franchises and one of my favorites. In the history of horror, the Phantasm film series has terrified fans for generations. Now get the exclusive Phantasm Sphere collection loaded with never-before-seen bonus features and an actual Phantasm Sphere replica. Look for it in December. It is the best gift ever, boy. And that is available from Wellgo USA.
All right, we are back. We're excited. Elric, I feel like you should take the lead almost. But
we did say to Robert seems to be in a similar state to us where we got back at 1 a.m. and I said, there's no way on earth I would want to do a show today on any planet. We already had a taped show. And when we found out you were here for one more day, we bent over backwards to make this happen because you are someone whose voice we really respect in this genre. I think, you know, with The Witch, I think you've made one of the best horror films of the last decade. Yeah. And now you've made a film that's, I think, almost unclassifiable. And that's a good thing. You know, any movie... just as an entry point, we watched the movie, and it wasn't till a week later that we went to Salem, and I was being driven from Boston to Salem along the waterfront and seeing the seagulls. And I got out of the car and go, man, the whole time I was thinking about The Lighthouse. Like, it was increasing in my brain, and it took some time. And I always think that's a really good thing for a movie, to let
this
it have
is,
some
time. By the way, this is Robert Eggers. That is Robert Eggers. Just, you know, long-winded introduction. But well, thanks for coming on, and we know you're exhausted as well from all the press.
But. Yeah, but I'm glad to be here. And, I mean, seagulls are – terrifying.
Just the way they look at you with those eyes.
Well, yeah. We're going to jump around quite a bit, but I mean, obviously, let's jump into the new movie. And it's so interesting because all of us saw it and we all had, I don't want to say vastly different reactions, but it is that type of film where people are going to see completely different things in it. And you know, and I'm A24 might not appreciate this, but I was like, and I hope you don't take it the wrong way. I was like, this is kind of amazingly one of the most uncommercial things that would play in a theater. And yet I'm so excited that it's going to play in theaters.
Yeah.
Cause it's a black and white movie. It's full screen. It's this great, character study with two characters. And I can't comprehend how the movie happened. Meaning between this and The Witch, you are a unique voice that I don't know anyone else that can make these movies. And it's an exciting time because I feel that way about Ari's movies. I feel that way about what Jordan Peele is doing. It's like we're getting a whole string of films from people that are very distinctly them. And so with this one, I thought I read in the Fangoria article.
Jennifer Kent too.
Jennifer Kent. Yeah, for sure. So, you know, where did this one, cause this one wasn't intended to be the follow up to The Witch originally. Was this kind of one of those ideas or projects that just kind of came up to the surface?
Well, you know, I started working on it with my brother, before The Witch was financed, and, I was thinking somehow that a two-hander in a lighthouse, if I found the lighthouse station, could be cheaper and maybe easier to finance than a movie about a bunch of pilgrims praying in the woods. But, you know, in hindsight, you can't make a lighthouse movie without a storm. And so there's no way to do this movie cheaply without it being even more art house than it is. And it is pretty art house. But, you know, again, I didn't think that a movie about a bunch of pilgrims praying would find much of an audience. I'm not an alchemist in my cell doing this stuff for myself. I want to share it with an audience. That's what this creative work is all about, is to kind of, you know, it's lonely being a human being. So we're trying to communicate like what it is to be human with other humans. That's what it's about, right? But even still, I thought there was a limited amount of humans that would give a poop about The Witch. But it was successful, you know? And so it opened doors that I was not expecting. And that's incredible. So I was developing some larger things. A lot of titles have been thrown around. We'll see if you can get me to say them if you want me to. But But I thought it would be wise to have something smaller in my back pocket just in case. So I called my brother up and I said, let's write that Lighthouse movie that we started talking about many years ago. And strangely, of all the things on my slate, the most uncommercial film was the one that got greenlit. And, you know, RT Features, they were the first people to put money into The Witch. And when I was saying I want to do this weird black and white Lighthouse movie about two lighthouse keepers farting in an obscure aspect ratio, it's actually box you narrower than full screen. It's an early sound aspect ratio, 1:19:1 movie tone.
Was there a particular film, was it like Vampire or something like that, inspired that choice? Obviously, it's claustrophobic. The film's all about feeling stuck.
Yeah, yeah. That's the reason why. I mean, you know, Jaron, the DP, suggested it many years ago kind of as a joke, and I thought that that was a great idea. There was a point when I was like, maybe it's a little bit too narrow. Mm. And so I started going through all my Fritz Lang again and checking out Vampire. And then, and I was, after seeing what Fritz Lang can do in an aspect ratio where he's telling movies that are not at all claustrophobic, right, I was like, okay, like we should be able to do it. But perhaps Kamerad Schaft was re-released by Criterion around this time. And it takes place in a mine, in these mine shafts. And they also have these vertical structures, the smokestacks. We have our lighthouse tower and you know, that was,
yeah. So that gave you the boldness
to, yeah. And I, and, huh, and these are the only two movies that probably should have been made in that aspect ratio. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that Fritz Lang would have loved to have a little more elbow, yeah, room, but he wanted to make a sound film in 1931 or two. And so that's the aspect ratio he was forced to use.
Yeah. And what, like, what also drew you to, like, did you have a obsession with, like, kind of maritime stories or, you know, The Call of the Sea? Because this obviously, I mean, without spoilers, there's an otherworldliness quality to this. It's like got the phantasmagoria without being, like, hard horror. I said to somebody, a student asked me who was really excited about it, and they're like, oh, you know, what is a horror film? And I'm like, no, what you're watching with this film to me is the director knows exactly the movie he's making. If you wanted this to be the most Lovecraftian movie of all time, you would have leaned a little more to the left if you wanted to, but you touch on these things and you give hints of that, but it's also more of a madness movie, more interested in the psychology of these characters strapped together with hints of the other.
Yeah, I mean, I because of the a lot of the theatrical disciplines that inspired this movie, I really don't know what genre this misshapen beast is. I think without Sam Shepard and Harold Pinter.
Pinter, I saw it, although the caretaker, it definitely.
For sure.
I saw the caretaker live once and watching this, I was like, yeah, you know, these two characters trying to, you stink from our soul to breakfast time is a line that always yeah, stuck with me, which would also work in your movie.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. But without that, I think it does follow the genre, the literary genre of weird, of a weird tale.
Yeah.
Of, you know, Lovecraft, Blackwood, M.R. James, Arthur Machen, so forth. But, you know, if this were truly Lovecraftian, when Robert Pattinson finally gets his hands on Willem Dafoe's logbook, it would be full of Dagon runes that right, tell you that what the light is an alien's out of, you know,
yeah.
And my brother and I preferred the more Jamesian approach, the more ambiguous approach.
I like about some of the films you've made so far is they're out of time, which means they're going to be timeless. Like, I feel like somebody can watch this 50 years from now and have the exact experience.
That's the hope. I mean, I don't know if it's always the exact experience.
Yeah, different, you
know,
for the time,
but if it is, if it is timeless, then you can. I'm not saying the movie is, but that's the intent. But if it is, then it works. You know, Marie Louise von Franz, a prominent Jungian, said that Hans Christian Andersen's fairy tales are going to slowly fall out of favor because they're too marred by his Victorian mindset. Whereas, you know, Grimm's fairy tales are more archetypal. And it is true, The Little Mermaid stuck around, but Hans Christian Andersen's canon is getting like is less and less read and talked about. But like Hansel and Gretel, Snow White, Sleeping Beauty, Rapunzel, they're not going anywhere.
Right, more like fables. There's some films that I was curious about. Like when it first ended, the first film I threw out to Robin, this one I've never heard or read you talk about, so I'm not even sure if you're aware of it, but it felt there's an Australian film that I've always loved called Wake and Fright. And I kept watching this going, wow, it's like Wake and Fright, but set in with only two people, claustrophobically in Lighthouse. But one thing I loved about that is there's this interesting transference. The other thing I wrote down was Drunk Dude Persona, which I liked because it's about you get these people and they're rubbing off on each other. They're transferring. It's kind of like their love stories, but not in that obvious way. Like it's not really about we're here because it's not – I don't think it's like it got a gay overtone. It's much more about the isolation of when two people are alone and that's the only other person there. You're gonna desire something. You desire some sort of connection. And Wake and Fright to me was like a nightmare when I saw that movie. Also, I'm from New Zealand, so seeing that film about the outback really connected with me and the Donald Pleasance character. But in this film, I really felt some of those same kind of characters. The other one was like that and Hour of the Wolf by Bergman. I know I've heard you and Ari discuss Bergman, but that was the one film where again you see Bergman always has an element of horror. The silence is really horrific, but Hour of the Wolf is the closest to real nightmares being portrayed. And I saw some of that elements. But what are some of the films that you that kind of not just necessarily inspire, but that you are fascinated? Because I always think that filmmakers who don't just say I'm a horror director, I always think often make the best horror films because they're interested in doing lots of other things, and those things often accumulate when they do to go to horror. There's another level of craft sometimes at work.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen Persona a lot. I've seen Hour of the Wolf a lot. I've seen Wake and Fright once, and it was incredibly effective.
I was thinking the seagull is the kangaroo. In
sure. Yeah. Only we didn't kill any real seagulls.
On the plus side, the only reason that director is actually anti Ted Kotcheff, he's anti all that. He was wanting to document what the government does.
No,
it's just natural.
Absolutely. And by the way, the lead in that, the ingenue, if you will, was like had a long term affair with Jeremy Brent, who played the Granada TV Sherlock Holmes.
Oh, weird.
With Edward Hardwick as Watson, talking about,
well, it homosexual comes all about masculinity overtones. Too. Yeah, that's a movie all about masculinity, deconstructing why it's a bullshit facade. Yeah,
and there's so many movies. I mean, we said Hour of the Wolf, but all of Bergman's chamber pieces on Fulra were inspiring to this movie. The nautical films of Jean Epstein that he filmed in Brittany, and Jean Grémion's Brittany-based nautical films too. Man of Arran, Robert Flaherty.
I definitely saw. I mean, I've seen it mentioned, but like the sequence at the start of Werkmeister Harmonies, where the people in the bar are basically orchestrating the universe, which is like Bellatar's work is like. Just to me, in terms of black and white orchestration, some of the best. But that sequence and Damnation are two that I definitely saw. Maybe aesthetically,
sure. I mean, absolutely. Like I love Bellatar, and how can you not be considering Tar if you're doing a miserable black and white
with
movie?
Drinking?
Yeah, but also these things folded in and out of each other.
Yeah.
I'm not like to say that I don't have influences that directly influence this thing is false. But on the other hand, like you don't have to have a nod to Bellatar's infinite winds because on Cape Foreshoe, on the southern tip of Nova Scotia, on a rock in the Atlantic Ocean, the wind never stops. And that's just a reality there.
Yeah, we were excited to see in that in the one interview Zulawski get a mention because obviously Possession has gotten a major resurgence, which is for obvious reasons. I think for a long time, America only had the American cut, which is a mess. So the fact that that film actually is in circulation again, but the I've always long said to people, I've actually never seen one of the ones you were talking about, which is The Devils. I've been waiting to see a better version, but the film of his that I think is his other best film is Third Part of the Night, which is his first film, and the energy of that film.
It's quite incredible.
Yeah, it's really electric, and I hope that one gets seen. It still hasn't been released by that company. There's like a one, maybe a polished disc, but what was it about? Is it about a work like Zulawski? Because again, these are the reason I think they are similar is these a director who can touch on horror elements and dread, but I don't think he's necessarily interested in it being a horror film in the way that maybe a marketing person is interested in a horror film.
Yeah, I haven't read a lot of interviews with Zulawski, nor have I listened to a lot of interviews with Zulawski, so I don't really know exactly from the horse's mouth what he was interested in.
But what do you react?
I would say that what I like about his movies and has something to do with this movie is ecstatic emotion. Mm. It's people who are experiencing things that are greater than everyday emotions. And there's been some, I mean, Zulawski performances oftentimes are legitimately stylized.
Yeah.
Sam Neill, legitimately stylized. But some of the really over-the-top stuff in The Devils and Third Part of the Night, and certainly like Isabella Gianni's scene in the subway station, I don't really think – I think that those are actually quite naturalistic. It's just they're extreme ecstatic states of emotion. And I think that sometimes people talk about Robin Williams' performances in this film as being stylized, but like – If you're cursing someone with a C curse, you're supposed to do that like subtly.
Yeah, right.
And if anyone has, you know, seen The Face of Madness, it's not normal. You know, it's extreme. So, anyway, Zulawski certainly knows how to capture that. I know that he was interested in Grotowski, obviously, and Buto. But my friend Sean also pointed out that he was interested in voodoo.
Yeah.
I'll try that.
Next
time.
Like Maya Darren or something. It's kind of. So talk about, like, obviously both films, one thing they have in common is period and utter attention to detail. Because I guess we don't know that much about you before we don't from The Witch. I know maybe you had some in production design slash costume experience on other films, but what is that? What is your interest in the kind of the authentic period and details in the stories you've told so far?
I just don't know any other way. Mm. And I like, I mean, I how. I like I like fairy tales. I like folk tales. I like mythology. I like religion. I like the occult. I like the past. Mm. That's where I spend my time. That's where I spend my imaginary time. Mm. You know, that's what I read about. That's where I like to play. And for me, like Guillermo del Toro can create beautiful worlds with his own imagination. He looks at the stuff that existed in the period, but then invents his own thing to suit the very specific story beats and characters and yada, yada, yada. And he does it beautifully. But I am more of the approach that Kubrick credits Franco Zeffirelli as being the first guy to do. He wasn't, but okay. Where you're trying to look at the material, look at the research and just do it. Mm-hmm. And I think because my films survive on atmosphere, if I don't have to make a choice, I just have to recreate the button, the lapel, the teacup, the kettle, the stove, and just do it. Then I have more time to recreate more things. Mm. And so the atmosphere can be more encompassing and more cumulative. I know what my high bar is. My collaborators know what that bar is, and there's no wasted time. And then you can create. I mean, the world. It's easier to create a credible world. It's just easier to create a credible world, and a world in which, because the floorboards and the shake shingles and the clabberds and the foghorn and the steam engine are also credible, then you can have a credible sea monster and a credible mermaid. Again, Shape of Water has a credible sea monster right. too, but it's a different. It's just a different approach, and that this is the approach that I like.
I
like the act of researching.
Right.
I actually just like the act of researching.
Well, I imagine the effect for actors must be really interesting, because it's like, it really is like stepping into a world for that period. So, I mean, watching that, I can only imagine when they're wearing these costumes in a isolated in a lighthouse, what that must do for their sense of buying into what this project is.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, Rob and Willem both talk about that. And Rob said often, if you take the camera away, he's just there in a lighthouse, in a 19th century lighthouse station. But, you know, in The Witch, I gave pockets were things that were exterior in the 17th century. So the family, like, they all have a little pouch that in that period was called a pocket. And I really wanted to be sure that each of the characters had all of the little implements that would actually have been in their pockets for their household and farm duties. And I put a lot of time and care and talking to the props master to make that happen. And the actors, when they received their pockets, they looked inside and saw their ear spoons and whatever were incredibly jazzed about it. But after a week, there was just cell phones and cigarettes in the pockets.
Modernity crept in. We were just talking about having been in Salem ourselves, and I was going to ask you behind the scenes, but did you play The Witch early on in Salem, or was it a press kind of event?
A24 kindly did a sneak screening with we did a bunch of press at the quote Witch House. And then we had a screening for some prominent witches, and we had a panel of historians, and so it was a real happy moment for me, because the historians, you know, noticed that we had the correct saw chatter on the floorboards, and you know, whatever, all my nerdy stuff that I care about, they appreciated it.
Yeah.
The poster's still up in the Salem Witch Museum.
That's cool.
Yeah. The whole, yeah. That's why we were just
there.
Are
they selling the DVD in the gift shop next to Hocus Pocus, I hope?
I don't know.
No, I actually think they were.
Were they really?
Yeah, I think they were. I did notice the witch. The witch was definitely there. I don't know if it was next to Hocus Pocus, you know?
Okay. Well, if it's not next to Hocus Pocus, it doesn't count.
Yeah.
I wanted to go back a little bit further to, you know, when you fell in love with movies, because we just love hearing that from all filmmakers that were video store kids. Obviously, for us, it was the video store, and then eventually cable and HBO and all that. So, but again, I'm also fascinated by how much you delve into research and just, you know, kind of exploring the past. So, where did your love of film start? Was it video stores as well? Was there someone in your family that watched movies with you? Or
I watched a lot of movies with my grandpa. Westerns and stuff, but he was into Indiana Jones and Star Wars, I mean, my whole family was down to watch movies, so that, you know, and of course, yeah, the video store, but like any good rural American, it was kind of Spielberg and George Lucas and that kind of stuff that got me excited about storytelling. Mm. I wasn't, you know, 6 years old watching Eraserhead, you know. But in high school, when you get to exploring the bottom shelf of the video store and you find Eraserhead, then you think, oh, wow, like there's other things that you can do with this. But yeah, there is a making of Return of the Jedi that I saw when I was probably six that made me realize, you make these things and this is how you do them. And all the maquettes and the puppets and everything that, and the world building excited me. And even as a kid, it tended to be, you know, I was in like Dick Tracy and Kevin Costner's Robin Hood and sci-fi movies, things that took you to different worlds appealed to me much more than Die Hard or whatever. It was, so even then it was, but if my parents would watch a Merchant Ivory movie, I would be interested. Mm-hmm. As a little kid, I could watch anything boring and just be fascinated about like, what are adults up to? But different worlds, going into different worlds.
And was there – what was the first when you became aware of that people make movies and it was possible, was there any specific goal in terms of how you wanted to get involved? Was it production design or did you always want to be a writer, a director? Like what was the entry point into breaking into the business, so to speak?
Growing up, I usually wanted to be a director or a visual artist. I went through a period of wanting to be a musician. Mm. I wasn't a very good one, but it's been incredibly helpful in doing film scores to have some music theory, and so I can kind of talk about some stuff.
What kind of music did you do?
I played electric bass and then upright bass first in a classic rock cover band, and then I began getting into jazz, which I don't almost ever listen to ever. I listen to classical music, folk music from around the world, and sort of dark post-metal electronic weirdy Viking adjacent stuff. what can you do? So I was always acting in theater growing up, and my dad was a Shakespeare professor. My mom had a kids' theater company. And I was exposed to this kind of stuff. I mean, look, if you just say my dad was a Shakespeare professor, my mom had a kids' theater company, and I lived in a clapboard house surrounded by white pines, like I wonder where the witch came from. Like, I mean, it's like, come on. But basically, I got terrible grades. And the only school I could get into was an acting school. So that would get me out of Cow Hampshire and into New York City. And then I was a working actor for a little while in off Broadway. And I kind of thought, you know, I can direct at least as poorly as the people who are directing me. So me and some friends started a theater company. And again, always been interested in sets and costumes. I wore costumes to school as a kid until I got beat up for it. So when we were doing this company with no money, I was doing the costumes and props and sets and stuff. I mean, we all worked together, truly, but I was really helming the design. And then a more experienced director saw a street theater piece that I was doing, and she asked me to design a play that she was doing. And then it was like a lightning bolt. This is how I can make a living as I'm trying to become a director. And that transitioned into film and non-union commercials and doing like print stuff for magazines and whatever. But that was how it was happening. But if I could beg, borrow, or steal enough money to direct something, I would do so. And then it came a time when it was, if I had any money, like I would take some time off to write, you know, to write The Witch, among other things. I kind of think this kind of details a little bit much because I've only made two movies over here, but you know, I'm still in the act of becoming myself and someone actually wants to listen to them speak about their childhood.
Well, what about short films though? Because short films are obviously a, you know, major build for most people. Did you use that format?
Yeah, I directed a really, really bad version of Hansel and Gretel, and I did everything. I designed the sets and the costumes, and I was the DP and whatever, but you have to do one of those. And then I did an adaptation of Poe's Telltale Heart, and Jaron Blaschke, my DP, Louise Ford, my editor, Damian Volpe, sound designer for The Lighthouse. That was our first thing we did together. And then many years had gone by. I was trying to get The Witch financed. No, it wasn't happening. And Jay Van Hoy and Lars Knudsen at Parts and Labor were like, look, you haven't made a movie in 5 years. And financiers want to see some recent work. And not only that, your Telltale Heart is like, you know, David Lynch meets Jim Henson, and like that has nothing to do with what you're trying to do with The Witch. So, so you should make a short film that A has scary woods, B is starring kids, and C has naturalistic performances. So I made a film called Brothers that does those three things. Mm.
And so that was partially responsible for getting The Witch in the right hands, you think?
No.
Okay.
but what it did do is that it gave me and my collaborators the confidence to say that we could actually make The Witch and it would work, and that I didn't feel like a snake oil salesman any longer.
Mm. So yeah, you had that confidence. So how did it go? How did it get into the right hands, and how did they have the confidence that you could, you know, actually make this film out of the gate?
Well, I didn't get into the Sundance labs, but Sundance still thought that there was something about The Witch that might work. They gave me some grants through CineReach, which was very helpful, and some mentors to read the script and give me notes. And then they had this thing called the Catalyst Weekend, where they had films that they knew about that might be commercial, and you would go and pitch your movie. And before I even pitched the movie, Rodrigo Teixeira at RT Features had read about The Witch in the pamphlet on the plane and wanted to talk with me. And I said a few things, and then he tracked me down as I was rehearsing my pitch and was like, shake my hand, yes or no, you know? And I was like, okay, cool. I mean, we needed to bring more people in after that, but that was kind of getting things going. Also, another one of our producers, Jody Redman, was doing a producer's lab and discovered that if we shot in Northern Ontario, not only would we be getting a great tax credit, but there was some money that we could get, a sort of it's pseudo grant if we were shooting up there. And I was sort of saying, like, I don't know if they have the right trees in Northern Ontario. They need to have the right forest system that looks like Southern New Hampshire or Northern Massachusetts. And the other producers were like, brother, like, they've got trees.
Right. And you just make it work. When that film came out, like, at what point did you know? I mean, I remember thinking this with Hereditary too. At what point do you see what you've created in terms of how it's hitting an audience? You know, because I think one thing I stopped doing a couple years ago is watching. I'll watch the first couple seconds of a trailer and then I just
close my. With you.
With The Witch, I had actually one of the best experiences I've ever had with doing that, which was. It was fucking terrifying keeping my eyes closed in the movies that I was going to. I'd start watching, close my eyes, listen to the sound, really take in, have no – what I like about doing that, I think people get it wrong. People think I'm scared of spoilers. It's not the case. What I don't want is I don't want to know the flavor yet. With Lighthouse, yeah. I'd seen that one still when it played in Canada. It's like, that's enough. I don't need to see the trailer because I want the flavor of the film to come at me and get to experience in that way. But with The Witch, that really worked for me because it built something up, but then it also completely delivered. And I think people have a very obviously both films get somewhat polarizing. I think they obviously connect with the right crowd, but some people are – it became whether it's elevated horror or – not realizing that that's always existed. It's called good horror. You know, when Friedkin made a horror film, it was elevated horror. When Polanski made – you know, the same kind of conversations. But at what point did you kind of tune into, oh, this is really catching on in a moment in that genre?
I mean –
Did you ever feel that from an audience, or did you?
I mean, when we screened the movie the first time at Sundance at the volunteer screening, and it seemed like it might be working.
Yeah,
and then it did well at Sundance, and it was shot. And then A24 bought the movie. It wasn't like some. Distributor that would put it in two movie theaters for it to die a quick death. It was pretty instant, but it was incredibly surprising.
Yeah.
Incredibly surprising.
And what about going with that distribution with A24? Because now you say it and you kind of know what kind of movie they're going to deliver and that they take these kind of movies seriously. But filmmakers spend so much time making the actual movie, and then distribution either screws it up and puts it in two theaters or just dumps it on VOD. How did you know them at that point were the right people to make sure this got out the right way? Or was it a leap of faith?
I mean, they described it well, although originally it was a day and date, which I did not want. And I mean, I can get into some like private conversations that I probably shouldn't get into, but in any case, when they were tracking the film, they realized that people were interested in it, and so then they were able to get rid of the day and date very quickly, and then it had quite a wide release in the end.
Yeah, which is such a rarity for, well, independent films at this point.
And but they didn't call it A Witch. They left it The Witch, which is rare in the current marketplace.
Sure,
right?
Yeah. You know? Yeah, it'll come up earlier.
Yeah.
do you care about people online arguing about if it's The Witch or the two V's, Vitch? Or?
Well, I mean, it's always pronounced The Witch, no matter how you spell it. I always write it with a W. Mm-hmm. The two V's was because it was from a witch pamphlet from the 1640s. They were kind of like tabloid newspapers of the day. And my understanding is that if you were a printing house, that you might not like spend all the money on all the different size typefaces. So you might have your W's for like a size 12, but a size 72, it was just two V's. And so there is this pamphlet that says V-V-I-T-C-H, and I thought that looks good, and it's from the period, and let's do it. But that said, most of the most ardent fans of The Witch, who are like really dedicated, who have Black Phillip tattoos and like shrines to this movie, they spell it with two V's. So I respect the two V
that dedication. Yeah, yeah. You know, what are some of the, because we talked about, you know, filmmakers like Bergman, the art house influences, but what are there, like when early horror films, when you're young, that caught your imagination, showing you this, you know, a different kind of reality?
All the Universal stuff was really big for me. Karloff's Frankenstein was scary and then sympathetic in the best way. I mean, I don't really like it very much now, yeah. But I loved Bela Lugosi's Dracula as a kid, but like it's kind of boring and crappy.
It's weird when you watch that in the Spanish one, you go, oh, the Spanish one's
so much better.
Yeah. That's a weird feeling. Yeah.
And Hammer was also really big.
What age would that be for you with Hammer? Like, is that you as a young person or
college? Yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah, for sure. Watching stuff on TV. A lot of the Christopher Lee stuff came on TV around the time that Bram Stoker's Dracula came out. But I had seen Peter Cushing Frankenstein movies before then. And then it's a little, you know, around that same time, I saw Nosferatu for the first time, and that was a movie that we bought. We couldn't get it easily; it needed to be ordered. But I found a picture of Max Schreck in the elementary school library in a book about vampires, and I was like, I gotta see this. And my mom was supportive of this obsession to see this movie, and we drove to the video store 30 minutes away and got it mail ordered, and I wore that VHS out.
Have you ever seen photos of him not in that costume? I never have. I'm just curious as an actor because I'd always loved those stories that kind of influenced, obviously, Shadow of Vampire. But was he a normal looking dude? I can't imagine.
He was gaunt, okay. Quite gaunt, yeah. Obviously, and trim. But he wasn't like super freaky.
He's not a monster. Yeah,
no.
What about Vampyr? Was that one as well, or
not as a kid?
Okay, yeah,
not
that's
as
a film
kid.
That's comes to later.
Yeah, but certainly later. Yeah.
So it, I mean, it seems very in line. A lot of that's period relevant. Bingo. So you weren't like the '80s horror kid who going to Poltergeist and stuff, or did those movies still influence
they
ju- you? Or
just they, honestly, they scared me way too much. I really just couldn't.
Because they're so
I
now.
Could not handle that. And well, it wasn't the nowness of it. It was just like they were. I mean, look, like the. I mean, you know, if Bela Lugosi could somehow scare me, and it was not scary at all, like imagine what like an actually scary movie is going to do to me. And I had, and I was always in interested in dark stuff and had an active imagination and was like legitimately afraid to be in the woods at night, like behind my house. So it was just too much. I mean, I saw it, the Tim Curry version, when I was like, I don't know, whatever, 10. And I just couldn't take a shower for like 6 months, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Some movies do have a crippling effect if you see them at the right age. I mean, what interests you about horror? Because like, is it the mood of the film, especially with The Witch, whether it's the stuff you're making or the stuff you react to, is it more about creating a mood or feeling than it is about, obviously more than jump scares, you know, that's clear in the work. But is there something that you like to kind of create or evoke in that?
I mean, most of the movies that I've written, I kind of start with the atmosphere first. And yeah, I mean, there is something, I mean, who doesn't want to like hang out in Tim Burton's version of Sleepy Hollow?
Right.
Yeah. Don't you just want to like live in one of those half-timbered houses and, you know, go out and empty your chamber pot and like smoke a pipe and wince, you know, I do.
That's very true.
You'd mentioned your love of Nosferatu before, and I'm just curious, like the thing that's exciting me about all these filmmakers that we talked about earlier, you and Ari, obviously, Jennifer Kent and all of them, is you guys keep creating films that are uniquely your own. But, you know, you were rumored to be attached to that. I would like to keep seeing original movies of you, but is Nosferatu the one exception because of your affinity for it? Is that like, or are there any other, dare I say, IP properties that you would want to take your spin on? Is it more just because of what that movie means to you?
Yeah, and that doesn't mean, I mean, that doesn't mean I should do it, you know? Probably, you know, the answer is probably no. At the same time, like, I don't know. I mean, the thing is, like, would I like to do Oliver Twist or Great Expectations? For sure. But, like, has anybody done a better job than David Lean? And we get one every 5 years, like, and so I don't know where to go with that. I think that with Nosferatu, the Murnau film is a masterpiece, but it is primitive. It is, you know. And the Herzog film, as much as I love Isabella Gianni and Klaus Kinski and Popol Vuh and the Mexican mummies and the whole thing, like, it's a front-lit, like, slapdash indie movie with incredible moments. But it, you know, and I mean, that's part of Herzog's thing, is you can watch a movie and 70% of it's not great, but the 30% of it is so magnificent that, like, your mind is blown and you talk about, I mean, to use the word ecstatic again, the ecstatic truth, which he's after. So I think that there's arguments to be made that, you know, using my approach, that there could be something more in something to mine out of Nosferatu, but maybe it is blasphemous.
Why do you think you're more drawn to Nosferatu versus, say, just Dracula? Mary Shelley's, Mary Shelley's. That's right.
It's okay.
You know what I'm talking about.
I'd love to. God, Mary Shelley's Dracula.
Mary Shelley's Dracula. that Bram Stoker's Nosferatu. Let's mix it up.
I think it's, I mean, look, Max Schreck, Count Orlok is a folk vampire mixed with Alban Grau, the producer, production designers, occult theories about vampires, and then it has still influences of the literary vampire that sprang from John Polidori. But overall, it's closer to a folk vampire than Dracula. Obviously, Stoker is drawing from folklore to create more specificity in his vampire mythology than the other English authors before him, but Orlok's the closest to a folk vampire. So for me, that's exciting, and it's Ellen's story. It's not Harker's story.
And it's not, romantic. It's a different kind of romantic. The Bram Stoker's is a romantic figure that they're creating, and
sure,
it's harder to see Nosferatu that way, even though he is. But he also looks ratish, and it's it creates a much different aesthetic, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And but it's also strange because it's like, well, what the hell's the point of remaking Nosferatu? In some ways, because what makes the Murnau film great? Yes, Murnau is like one of the finest directors of the silent era or any era, but it's Max Schreck's performance that is the movie.
Yeah.
You know.
And way it moves, the way he moves towards the other characters on the camera and just staging and these kind of elements. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that movie also sort of, obviously there's horror films before it, but it also sort of invents the horror film. And there's even some things about the editing that are just like inventing cinema. So there, there's a lot of good things about the movie, but it's Max Schreck's performance. It's really Max Schreck's performance. So, if one was to remake Nosferatu, well, you can't do that again.
Yeah.
Max Schreck's performance, you got to do something else. So then what are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
Question mark. Question mark.
The
question
unknown, mark. Right? Yeah. Is that something you had to kind of work through? Because obviously at some point that might have been on the road to be your next film. Did you have to like really dig into that yourself to decide what to make next? Or was it more of a what project actually emerges to get made next?
You don't, the Norn weave a mysterious thread, and our fates are unclear. But I'm not gonna poke my eye out and hang upside down on a tree for the knowledge of my fate. So weird shit happens, and I have to deal with it.
And see what I mean, if it led to The Lighthouse, which strikes me as a harder film. It feels like if I would just be guessing, it'd be easier for you to get a Nosferatu made at some point than a Lighthouse made. So I'm glad The Lighthouse gets made first, because that's a film that, while you're coming off the heat of something like The Witch, that might never exist otherwise. Obviously, with the star powers, the other thing that I imagine gets a film like that greenlit is a big part of it. And you get, again, two of the I thought Once Upon a Time is one of the films that had great this year, had great chemistry on screen between two people. I think this is one of the other films this year where you have two people just got there. There's a sequence, the what sequence is, it's electricity you're feeling. And I don't know how much, it almost feels like old theater games of getting
to character. It's a total Meisner.
Yeah, exercise. Meisner, the repetition. Yeah. But it is electric. And I think it's a movie that I want to see a second time, because so much of it is, even while you're watching it, you're building what you think it's going to be in your head. And you're pushing in directions. And it's one of those movies I look forward to jumping in again to go, okay, now I know what it was, at least what I saw. Now I want to experience again with that knowledge and kind of feel it out. Because there are certain images from it, like all great movies like this, especially ones that have hit horror moments, you keep thinking about them because they are brief.
Mm-hmm.
There's certain images of a certain woman in this that I don't want to give spoilers, just things that kind of stuck in my brain, like weird little flashes that I love it when you can't start discerning your dreams from weird movies you've watched, and kind of like Eraserhead when you first see Eraserhead. I love that feeling. So on that level, I'm glad this was the second movie, not Nosferatu, regardless of, and hopefully that still does exist at some point.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad this was the movie that was made.
Well, you've been awake a long time. How do Willem and Robert Pattinson feel when they finally saw the film, like for the first time? Was that at Cannes as a group, or did you screen it before?
I screened it. I wanted them to see it before, But they, they like it.
Yeah.
They're proud of their work. I think,
Yeah. It's just so specific. Like, the dialogue is so interesting because it takes a minute. Like, Willem Dafoe's just going all in sea shanty dialogue. That, to me, again, part of the research, like, that is so specific. Thankfully, they didn't put subtitles up like they did for Nil by Mouth, which I'll never understand. seeing it in an American theater, seeing subtitles on an English speaking movie, but that's all right. But, like, how hard was that? Like, was that something in the writing that you guys had to research to even put in the text, or?
Yeah, I mean, my brother and I don't speak in rarefied coastal Maine 19th century dialects, so we did have to research that.
Yeah.
The first place you're going to look if you're doing New England in this period in nautical, you're going to open up Melville.
Yeah.
And we looked at lighthouse keepers' journals and logbooks. I looked at interviews with lumberjacks for Robert Pattinson's character. We looked at all kinds of stuff, and there's tons of dictionaries of sailor words and slang.
Yeah.
But we discovered this author, Sarah Orne Jewett, from the state of Maine. She was writing in the same period as our film takes place, and she was interviewing sea captains and sailors and farmers and writing her Maine stories in dialect phonetically. So that was super helpful. And then my wife found a thesis about dialect in Sarah Orne Jewett by a woman named Evelyn Starr Cutler. And she broke down the dialects and provided rules. Mm. So then we could make sure that we were being consistent all the way through. And so that was fun and challenging. But with the sort of faux Shakespearean, faux Miltonian sea curses, like I can kind of just do that now after The Witch and some other stuff. So that was just, you know, I mean, to say off the cuff is not true because it took some work, but you can tell,
you can see that. How much freedom do the actors in your films get to add, whether it's story information or improv lines, obviously, especially when you're in dialogue like this, this has a feeling when they're, say, the what sequence, it feels spontaneous. So that could just be a testament to what they're bringing to your script, but I'm curious.
No, there's nothing, they are not allowed to do anything.
Except make it real.
Yeah.
make what you wrote authentic. No, and that's a real testament in this one. Like The Witch, that would make sense to me. But this film, a lot of it just feels like they're just in the moment, and the moment keeps growing and growing in this back and forth, like the ultimate grumpier old men.
Yeah, but I mean, if you're not in the moment, then the movie falls flat and doesn't work. I mean, Willem's been talking a lot about how improvising something doesn't necessarily mean it's good or better or anything. And you can be preparing for something you know you're going to do. But when you are in the moment, it's as if that moment the spirit inhabits you or something. Mm. Yeah, I don't think you would go that far, but you know, but you are just kind of lost in it. Mm. So then it is spontaneous, even if it's something that you've planned to do.
Hmm. And I guess the one thing it has been announced, obviously, what the next film is, just in terms of a setting. Obviously, you're not going to want to say much about it, but is that another period, the Viking period, is something another period you've always been fascinated, obsessed with? Or
actually, no. Hmm. My wife is much more into the Viking, was. I'm like totally fucking
into
obsessed
it now.
Okay, right. And have been for several years.
Okay.
I went to Iceland. Uh-huh. And when we were driving from Keflavik to Reykjavik, I thought, okay, well, I guess I need to make a Viking movie because the landscapes are, you know, unlike anything you've ever seen. And then I met an Icelandic novelist and poet named Sjón, who was a real kindred spirit and much more talented than me. And so we decided to give it a go.
So it's an original script. It's not coming from a novel or it's not an adaptation of any, huh?
It's based on some legendary sagas, but it's our own story finally, and we use the sagas of the Icelanders to enrich it with the legendary saga with naturalism.
Mm. Okay, cool. And you're already starting casting that, so this is a go picture.
It's never a go picture. It's never a go picture.
Never until you're shooting.
Yeah.
Until I'm saying action, it ain't happening.
One of the last things I wanted to bring up is, sound design and score is so pivotal to these films, especially creating the mood. What is it like working with Mark Corvin? Because he's the composer on both your films, and you had mentioned earlier that you have your own music history as well, playing in bands and stuff. So is that equally as important a collaboration and element to what you're doing?
It's massive. Of course, it's massive. Mark's great. Mark's flexible. He doesn't have a big ego, unlike all my other collaborators. And so when Mark kind of says, actually, that's not good, that sucks, you're like pretty sure that must be terrible, you know? Mm. Mark, I wanted this film to be like only horns and pipes and brass and concertina and windy, blowy things that sound like the sea and the foghorn and Willem Dafoe's flatulence. Mm. And Mark was saying from the very beginning, I think you're going to want to have some string textures. And I was like, no. Because The Witch was so string heavy. And I felt like in this post Johnny Greenwood world of art house stuff, we've done screechy strings to death and so many beautiful renditions of screechy strings, but like, okay, come on. But you know, there's a reason why those Penderecki-esque string rises are in every fucking horror movie. It's because they work. So we do that once or twice, but then we had an experimental session with some string players to try to find some other string textures that could do the same thing without being that. And we did, and that was very satisfying. But then as we moved forward with the score, there was nothing that was acknowledging the fact that, like, to say it the most simply, it kind of looks like an old movie. We needed to have some low string motifs that kind of had a scent of Bernard Herrmann. Mm. And, you know, the opening sound cue is probably the most memorable to me example of that.
Yeah.
So yeah, Mark Corvin, you got to listen to that guy because he knows what he's doing.
Very cool.
The last thing I guess we often ask people, like, we're always curious, besides Ari and Jordan and Jennifer, which you've mentioned, are there contemporary movies that obviously there's tons of movies, but specifically within the genre that you see that are still inspiring and pushing you and making you realize like how far you can kind of push into what genre elements are or what it may be interest you? I'm just curious. I saw a film this year that I thought was pretty interesting. The Hagazusa was an interesting film that had moments that were, you know, different that I hadn't seen. That was period, you know. Just curious.
That's a good movie. It's definitely it's fairly ambient, but yeah. It's a good movie. That there like a some it was some Baltic like Estonian movie November.
Yeah,
cool,
yeah.
Cool film. Man,
that
cool
one
film.
Really stuck with all
we
of us
saw because it at a film festival last year. And we
especially
were just,
the lore of the you know the what were they Krapits or whatever the,
yeah,
the
whatever
creations those,
yeah.
Were you just hadn't seen that and it also had the strange comic tone to it that you weren't expecting.
Yeah, I mean there's a lot of stuff in. I don't know about Estonian folklore, but yeah. I know a lot about like Transcarpathian and Slavic folklore, and there's a lot of you know. Vampiric garden hose and like haunted yeah. hay bales. So seeing that in November was yeah. really
and a tragic snowman. The saddest yeah. snowman I've ever. Yeah.
That was good. And but I mean, there's you know, Yorgos, his work.
Yeah.
It, you know, come on.
Yeah, Killing of a Sacred Deer. It felt like a horror film to me.
It's, yeah, I love Killing of a Sacred Deer. Really, I mean, I saw that. I don't tend to watch contemporary movies more than once.
Yeah.
And I watched that one a few times. Mm. I thought Burning was quite incredible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Ciro Guerra does, I'm very interested in.
I don't know if I know.
Embrace the Serpent.
Oh, I saw Embrace the Serpent.
Birds of yeah. Passage and...
I work at a film school, and one day one of the acting teachers walked by me, and I was just like, "You just look like someone I've seen." And he was the lead from the Serpent film. He was the captain guy.
Oh yeah, and
Breon
and,
Davis, yeah,
and he was in like a Dutch ? Movie where he plays a kind of boogeyman who's
he has these eyes that
yeah, but there's a scene where he's sitting on a woman's chest naked, like
Borgman. Oh, Borgman's an interesting
film. That was a cool movie.
Yeah, that's an interesting
I haven't thought about that in a while.
Yeah, I'd actually forgotten about that one until just then. Yeah. But that's the image you remember, that yeah. a head in a can of some kind,
right,
upside
right,
down.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
But so you're still seeing, obviously you're often on festival circuits and whatnot.
I mean, right now, because I've been doing so much press for Lighthouse and I'm prepping this thing and I got a one-year-old, like I've seen Once Upon a Time, Ad Astra, Waves. Nothing else this year.
How's Waves? I'm looking forward to it.
It's incredible.
Creature was one of my favorite films that year, so
yeah,
I'm excited.
Me too.
To see what
it's incredible. It's cool. It's incredible.
Cool.
It's incredible.
And it's not a commercial for A24. Right? Your hall appearance. That's A24, isn't it?
It is.
It
but,
is. Yeah, yeah.
But it's. I love Trey.
Yeah.
Okay. Not that I don't love A24, but I'm not going to like. Yeah, yeah. And I advocate for A24 movies I don't like or haven't seen.
You really love it. Yeah. Yeah. So Lighthouse is going to be obviously out now.
It's out in theaters now,
because this will come out on Friday.
Okay.
The film's out in theaters. I hope people go in with open mouth and just enjoy, because I think you actually really nailed it. I think where people struggle to maybe pinpoint it, the old series Weird Tales, that really does fit to me.
I think that it's important for people to know that it's supposed to be funny.
Yeah,
I think that funnily enough, a lot of the audience members that have been kind of disappointed are big fans of The Witch, who are expecting like a super austere, humorless misery fest. Mm. And so then when Willem Dafoe farts, they wonder, oh, how do I react to a serious fart? And then they're all thrown off.
Yeah.
But if I was going to explore misery again, I wanted to be able to laugh in the face of misery this time around.
And the arguments about cooking is just, it's fantastic. it's in theaters now. So, and obviously that's a way to see a movie like this, especially, with some of the craft, it's just the world you guys have created. I think to see it on as big a screen as possible is the way to go.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. See it in IMAX.
Yeah. Will it play anywhere in IMAX?
Actually, you know what? It screened on an IMAX screen at TIFF, and it was quite something. And I'm tired of this movie. I don't want to ever watch it again. But when we were doing the tech check, I kept saying, show me this scene. Cause it was very interesting. And I think A24 has been trying to contest Disney to get some screens away from Maleficent, but they're never going to win that battle.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But God bless A24 for trying.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We'll get out there and support the Seagull movie. So, it's fascinating. Thanks for, I know this is a long, I feel like at least we got to come in and suffer with you.
Yeah,
we're all delusional.
And we're just like talking about random stuff, which is a little bit easier than like it all started back in,
Favorite curse word. Yeah. No, thanks for doing this. And I love that movies like this get made. I think they create, we're really lucky in the kind of movies we get to explore these days. I haven't seen Parasite yet, but I hear that's great too. So
yeah, I'm super pumped to watch
it. Yeah. Looking forward to that. When you get that break, good luck.
I know.
Thanks for coming in.
I want to see the new Peter Strickland movie.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, God, there's so much stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, you haven't seen in Fabric?
I haven't seen it.
Oh, you're going to like that one, I think. And again, similar thing where the first half you wouldn't know you have permission to laugh, and then it really becomes clear. And I bet you people had the same probably problem. So
yeah,
cool. Okay, well, best luck. Hope it opens. Hope people get it. Yeah.
Me too.
All right, thanks. We'll see you.